Welcome to the Coaching Culture Podcast. I'm JP Nurbin, the founder and director of TOC Culture Consulting and the author of my latest book, The Culture System. My co-host, Nate Sanderson, is going to interview me today. He's going to interview me about my newest book, and he honestly is the toughest critic I know when it comes to leadership and culture books. So I think you'll appreciate this interview. If you want to pick up a copy of the book, ebook or paperback, you can click on the links in the details of this episode, or just head on over to myculturesystem.com for links there. We're going to jump right into this conversation because it's a fairly lengthy one.
Well, JP, it's exciting times for you here as your new book has dropped on Amazon in most of the world, at least as of this recording. And we're going to sit down and talk a little bit about the journey that you went on kind of putting this book together. And talk a little bit about some of the ways that I think it's one of the most unique culture building books available on the market, and kind of how you've positioned it to be both a practical guide for coaches, but also to ask some challenging questions to help them continue to develop their own philosophies and be able to grow independently on their own. But I want to start with this. This isn't your first book. You wrote a fable a few years back. Took a couple years in between now writing the second book. And I'm just curious, coming off of the first book, calling up and just thinking through kind of the process that you went through, where did the idea for this second book come from?
Well, Nate, I think it came early on as I had written Calling Up and was working with a lot of coaches on applying some of the strategies and tools that we found to be really effective, or we thought might be effective in those early days. And we said we start trying some of those things out, those strategies and tools to build culture. I started to realize early on that it's great to have these ideas. It's great to have the, you know, something like your captain's council or a certain skill around how to engage in some helpful and motivational type conversations with your players. But bringing that all together in the life of a coach and all the other things they have going on is really, really hard. And so I that's where I kind of started to land on that idea of a system and bringing it all together. So the idea for this book came about probably around 4 years ago, just after I'd finished Calling Up. But it's taken a lot of time to really study and try out these different strategies, and then also to help coaches to build systems into their life, into their program, so that they can kind of stay consistent on them. And then, so it's really not just my work, it's the work of all these other coaches that have allowed me to use them and use their teams to kind of experiment. And we've had some great successes along the way. We've had some areas where things didn't work out, but we've learned from them all, and I was able to put them into a book now.
I think that's one of the interesting things about this book compared to, let's say, Daniel Coyle's work. When he wrote The Talent Code or The Culture Code, a lot of what he was doing was researching existing organizations or going in and observing teams and trying to find out what do they have in common? What are they doing that's working? You know, he's looking for the secret to their success. And when you think about Joe Erman's book, Inside Out Coaching, that's a lot of reflecting on his own journey. It's a very personal tale of his development of his coaching philosophy. There's some practical questions in that book too, but what's interesting, I think, about how yours has come together is it's a little bit of both. There's a bit of your own journey in there. There's a bit of observing, and as you mentioned, doing research, but there's also a lot of JP in the laboratory working with a lot of the coaches that we work with in the mentorship program. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about just that as a unique way of kind of putting these strategies together and the importance of kind of using some of our coaches in the field to test some of these systems to know that they work.
Well, I think first off, I have to say I'm just incredibly grateful that so many coaches have allowed me to work with them over the last few years. You know, some of them I think were crazy too. You know, I didn't tell them initially that, but it's really been unique. I mean, I think most books that we write, a coach might write, they're based on their experience with that one team or that team over a period of time. And I've just been able to be on the inner workings of so many teams. And I remember reading The Power of Moments by, you know, the Heath brothers, and how they were, you know, there's a traditional book like The Culture Code, but they had case studies at the end. And these case studies that they shared at kind of the end of every chapter were like how you might apply this idea or concept. But I thought, man, how cool is it for me to be able to just pull all these examples of how coaches have actually applied this and the amazing benefits that it had for their program. And we end up having, you know, 20 chapters in the book. It's two extras that are bonuses as well too, that you can kind of get off the website, but so it's 22 in total. There's 22 main kind of stories at the end of every chapter that kind of tells of it in action, you know, put, you know, we call it all those case studies, but, and that's really, really powerful because I think it's great to hear the story of Theo Epstein and how he, you know, he turned the Cubs around. But most people are not managing the Chicago Cubs or a Major League Baseball team. They're coaching a high school baseball team, you know, or they're coaching a Division III, you know, small town baseball team or a minor league team, right? Whatever it is. But, and I think it's really important for people to see how can you take these principles, these strategies and tools and how you apply them and know that they actually have worked. And the cool thing was, it was actually really hard at the end of the day defining, you know, finding which is the best one, you know, and it was, you know, because there's so many great examples of these tools and methods put into action.
Now, one of the things that's also, I think, unique about just kind of where your position in the industry, so to speak, is that you're working with coaches at the collegiate level, at the high school level, the small college level. We've worked with coaches that are in soccer and basketball is probably the main sport that we deal with. But we've had volleyball coaches and track coaches and football coaches. And how did that kind of diversity or that access to a lot of different coaches' experiences at different levels and in different sports kind of help you be able to refine some of these systems?
Yeah. And I think that the diversity of opportunity to work with people has been critical. In fact, we can add to that list ice hockey, rugby, as well, you know, ice hockey being one of the big ones actually, but also some businesses. You know, I've had the opportunity to work, you know, one of the characters in the book or the case studies is of Clint Halliday, who is a, you know, under seven soccer coach who reached out to me years ago to work with me in the mentorship program. But he also is, you know, kind of like the second in command at a, you know, boat cover manufacturing business out in Salt Lake City. And so it's a really cool story of, you know, how I've also been able to help him not just work on his coaching with under seven or under eight soccer, but also with his business. And the cool thing is you, as you see all these varied contexts, different sports, different levels, different countries, you start to see where adjustments need to be made, but also what are just the foundational principles to applying some of those strategies that are universal. So I think that's where I really try to focus the book on is like, here's what you need to know to be able to apply it. And then you got to also take it and tailor it to your context because culture is complicated, right? It's made up of people. Everybody's context is different. So I've really tried to give it to that. And then you know, we're going to launch an online course later on. That's probably a little bit more detailed. And then there's the next level of support and mentorship, which we obviously, you know, me and you work with coaches to tailor some of these things to their context even more so. But I really wanted to kind of just give, hey, this is what you need to know and not a lot of other extra stuff that's going to kind of confuse coaches, you know?
I think just, you know, the conversation that we've had over the years and being able to work with some of the coaches with a lot of the strategies in the book, that there's that principle in the scientific community of replication, right? Like you make a discovery or you come up with a theory, but it has to be replicated by others in order to be proven true. And I think in a lot of ways, your experience, our experience in working with different levels and different sports, as you said, has kind of allowed the thread, as you mentioned, the universal part, you know, to sort of surface to the top that hopefully can be accessible to everybody that reads the book, which again, I think is really unique because usually when we're reading about you know, some of these principles that other authors will write about, it's out of one context rather than, you know, coming from dozens of different contexts and still finding some of these common threads. Now, one of the influences you write about in the book, and we've had James Clear on the podcast when his book Atomic Habits dropped a couple of years ago, but the principles here are really rooted in systems. And that word keeps coming up in our conversation here, and obviously it's littered throughout the book. You want to just give us just a sense of why it's systems and not just principles and strategies.
Yeah, because when it comes to systems, and this is interesting because you bring up CLEAR. I look at my own journey, personal growth journey, and I've shared some of it on the podcast before. But I've really started to accelerate my own growth because I've been consistent in really the last 4 to 5 years. And CLEAR's book, Atomic Habits, was one of the most impactful in that. And it provides a system, to develop good habits and break bad ones, And there's tools with that. There's the habit journal. There's these little strategies and stuff. But I developed a system within my life. And so before that, I always wanted to read more. I always wanted to stay more consistent around exercising or meditation or all these other things, eating healthier. But all I had was goals. I didn't have systems. And I think it's the same in culture. Every coach right now in the world is looking forward to next year. We've got goals. We're excited about them. If this is going to be the year that we're going to change things. And then the shit hits the fan, You get into the rush of the season. You got practices, you're rushing home from practice to eat with your family. You lose a few games, you get a couple nasty parent emails, and everything just kind of goes out the window. You don't have time for your captain's council. You don't have time for all these other things. And you get caught up in the strategy and the X's and O's, and you kind of lose your way. And so what I've tried to do is build something here that can help us to stay consistent at what's most important. And I'm giving you 20 tools essentially over the course of the book that I've seen and have been consistently used across not just the coaches I work with, but exceptional cultures and leaders. Now, not everyone uses all 20 tools. In fact, I don't know anybody that uses all 20 tools. They use different ones from each of the four categories, which I know we're going to talk about. But they use them consistently over time. And that's where they see the results. So that's the key, is knowing what's essential for your culture out of all these tools, and then being able to consistently apply them. Like Dave Brandt says on our podcast, when we interviewed him 10,000 times, right? He says, step 7 for culture building is repeat steps 1 through 6, 10,000 times.
I want to ask you this question from a reader's perspective, thinking about, you mentioned 20 chapters, lots of strategies divided up into kind of the four categories of the framework that we'll get into here in just a moment. If I'm picking your book up for the first time, I've got problems in my culture. Maybe it's relationships, maybe it's parents, maybe it's systems and strategies, who knows? In a lot of ways, JP, it kind of reminds me of laying out the socket set, where you've got all of these different wrench sizes that you could use on to tighten nuts or bolts or whatever it might be. And look, I don't have a handy gene in my body. Like, I can't fix anything. So I grab one of those and I put it on the bolt. And if it doesn't fit, I grab the next one and put it on the bolt. It's a lot of trial and error for me when I'm trying to find the right tool. So when a coach is reading through this, how will they recognize what tools are right for their situation?
Well, I think, and then we talk about this in the book, but it's really important to recognize you're already doing some of these things. What I'm laying out here is what you're already doing it, or what you're already doing. It's about doing it with a little bit more intentionality and just making some changes and then being consistent on those, on that strategy, that tool. So first off, it's just look at what am I already doing? Because if you're already doing something, having player one-on-ones, establishing standards, or holding people accountable in different ways, if you're already doing these things, you just need to make some tweaks. You need to bring some more intentionality into that. And that makes it high impact, but easy to implement. And Coyle talks about that actually in the Culture Playbook. He talks about pick the strategies that are going to deliver high impact, but are easier to implement. And that's where my suggestion is for coaches is just get going, on a few things within the kind of the four main parts of the book. Just get going on a few things that you're already doing that will be easy enough for you to implement. And a lot of these things, they're really done in maybe an hour-long meeting at the beginning of the year. But then you have the tools to support what you did earlier in the year throughout. So that's why you have to be using all the different kind of main four parts there.
Well, I love that approach because I think you're right on. You know, in some ways, it's like, geez, I've been meeting with captains for my whole career, but here's a better tool. You know, here's a better way maybe to conduct those meetings or to meet with them more often, or a system that reminds me of the importance to use my captains in this way, A, B, and C, whatever it might be. And I think there's also things that coaches will find in the book where there are strategies where they think, I've never thought about that before, like restorative consequences or progressive consequences. When we get into kind of enforcing the standards, you know, there's not a lot of coaching conversations that I have by the water cooler where coaches are saying, how can I restore this player after they've screwed up or after they were late for practice or whatever, right? So in that regard, I think it's an engaging read for coaches because you can compare what you're already doing to some strategies that have worked. And you might be surprised by being challenged by some whole new ways of thinking about other things that you've never tried before. And in both cases, I think it gives you an opportunity to really grow your culture in a very specific way. So as we get into thinking about the framework that you've laid out, you kind of have four main pillars here. And we're going to talk kind of in general about why you chose each one of those and laid them out as you did in the book. And the first one that you start with is the importance of having a transformational approach. And you know, we've talked off air. I think that's one of the unique things about, again, that's different maybe than from some of Coyle's work as an example, is that before you even get into kind of the universal truths of some of your systems, you start with the internal work that has to be done by the coach for all of these things eventually to be successful. Why do we start with transformational coaching and the inner work for coaches to do?
Well, it's funny, Nate, because as we were going through the long, arduous, you know, 6 to 8 month process of editing this book, it came up multiple times. Do we need to remove this? Is this necessary? Is it essential to the culture system? And I kept coming back to, you know, I know that it's been talked about before, you know, transformational leadership and this type of philosophy and having a philosophy. There's plenty of other really good books that do this that I love. But I can't leave it out because it's just absolutely critical. Without this philosophy, then nothing else works. At the end of the day, if we're not clear on what's important to us, you know, what we're trying to create within our team, and also we don't have the right mindset towards people, we're operating in a transactional way, I really don't want to endorse you using the system. There's no guarantees that it will work. In fact, I think it will fail, okay? Because people will see right through you. Where I think it's different in maybe some other books around this, you know, idea of laying out your philosophy is I think I've done a lot of reflection and inner work, and I've written mission statements and core values and those type of things. And they're important, but they often become just cliche. They don't actually really become a part of who I am as a coach. And so I really try to incorporate some practical ways that I've helped other coaches to stay true to that mission, to continue to work towards that vision, to actually align their behaviors with, you know, their beliefs, their core values, you know, something that I struggled with for a very long time, and to have some disciplines in our life to stay grounded in that and in the most difficult times. And so I think that's what's why it's a little bit unique as a section on philosophy, you know, leadership philosophy, but it's absolutely vital because we said on this podcast a million times, to have a better culture, you've got to become a better leader. To become a better leader, you've got to become a better person. You know, and that's kind of really at the core of it is working on ourself.
Well, I think the other thing that's different about how you've positioned the book and your philosophy just with TOC and all the things that we're doing here is that these aren't just systems designed to enhance performance. But ultimately, when you start by grounding in a place of transformational culture, a transformational approach to leadership, there's systems that are designed to bring change in the lives of other people. I think that orients and is the common thread that kind of ties every single one of these strategies and all four of the sections of the book together. Is that at the end of the day, yeah, we're driving toward a more successful culture. We want to have better performance for our teams. But the ultimate mission, the ultimate purpose in some manner or another is we want to make our players into better people as well. And I just don't, again, as we've mentioned many times, like that's unique, right? Where all the systems are drawn back to that sort of core value at its root.
Yeah. And what I would add to that is, in my personal experience and the experience of working with our coaches and leaders, is that when we really set out to have that impact on other people's lives, it impacts our life as well. You know, back to the whole point, you're going to have to grow. You're forced into growth, into change. But that's the beautiful part about this whole journey, is that so much of how we establish, support, and enforce the standards, you know, so much of those processes and those tools that I share in the book, so much of that is dependent upon us modeling this change, us, you know, working, not always living to the standards, but working to live to the standards. And that's the beautiful thing about it. If you fully commit to this philosophy, this way of, you know, viewing leadership, is that the journey, you really never can fail. You can make mistakes. You can have the wrong reaction with the player. You can make the wrong decision, but you're always seeing it as an opportunity to grow. And you're always working on yourself throughout it. And you're leveraging those mistakes to your actually advantage, you know. And hey, come back to Coyle. Coyle talks so much about that, you know, leveraging our own mistakes to set the example for others, you know, for change and for vulnerability.
I think that bridges into the other foundational piece at the beginning of the book, which is standards and relationships have to both be high. Like, I think a lot of coaches, we think, okay, I got to fix my culture. So I've got to have some non-negotiables and I've got to set some boundaries and we've got to have standards. And maybe the players are part of, you know, setting that, our rules for the team, whatever it might be. But neglect or just innocently ignorant of the importance of relationship and connection. And on the other side of that, there are times where coaches are all about connection and relationships and getting to know their players and struggle to enforce standards. Why does it have to be both?
I've always tried to come back to this graph that's actually in the book. And on the x-axis is the relationships, the y-axis is the standards. And I've shared this in many workshops over the years, Nate, where at a certain point, your relationships can only be so strong if you're not holding those individuals to a standard. So I can invest in people and have one-on-ones and we can have fun culture days and all that stuff. But if we don't have a high standard here and we're not holding you to that high standard, I don't really care about you. You know, like there has to be, and that's just in the same in parenting, right? So you have to have relationships to be able to hold people to a standard, to raise the standards in there, and really to hopefully do that intrinsically within your culture. And on the other side of that, you know, if you try to go in there and not have relationship and you try to hold people to a high standard, you'll just get rebellion. There won't be any buy-in into those standards. And I've experienced that firsthand, you know, and I think that was kind of a big, you know, point or driving point of my book, Calling Up, is like it first starts with building, you know, relationships while raising those standards. But it's all in all one process of establishing the culture, which I see as the strength of our relationships and how high our standards are.
Well, and that kind of brings us to the second pillar here, which is establishing standards. And I was listening to our friend Cody Royal was on a podcast with our other friends, TJ Rosine and the Hardwood Hustle here last week. And he was talking a little bit about how a lot of our coaching practices were modeled after kind of the military approach in the 1940s and 50s, very top-down, very hierarchical, very command and control, sort of centered with the leader, you know, dictates what the followers should do. And over the course of the last 50 or 60 years in the military, that is transition. And we've talked a lot about this on the podcast. Coyle's talked about this in his book too. Leadership that is more horizontal, it's more conversational, it's more of a collaboration between follower and leader when it comes to identifying and enforcing the standards. Why is that conversation and the inclusion of athletes in that process of establishing standards so important?
Well, it's funny you mentioned the military thing, because the first chapter in part two of establishing relationships and standards there and establishing the culture starts with the story of Mike Abershoff, Captain Mike Abershoff, who we had on this podcast, and, you know, got to read his book and got to have him here on the podcast to learn about how here is a guy in the military who turns around the worst ship in the Navy to make it the best ship. And what's he do? He spends the first 6 weeks pretty much, you know, 40 plus, you know, hours a week in one-on-ones, bringing his sailors into his office, you know, asking them about his family, their families, you know, showing them pictures of his journey, telling his story. And he, you know, new sailors come on that ship. He's calling their parents, you know, telling them they arrived safely. He's reaching, you know, I think that's just so cool. Here's a guy in the military that's actually reaching out and connecting with parents, you know, and building those relationships. So it's cool you mentioned the military thing, because you start to see, as you said, the military even has had to evolve in that. Now, to come back to your question about why it's so important that we collaborate with players when establishing standards, you know, and one of the chapters I talk about non-negotiables, which are coach standards. They're driven from the coach and they're about what's important. But I think even the way that we communicate those as to how they benefit the individual, the team, and the relationship with the head coach is really, really important. And we talk about that. But when it comes to working with your players to establish standards there, it's helping them to see the behaviors that are going to be necessary and helping them to identify what they believe will be necessary for us to be successful. And that could be successful as far as winning a championship, but also beyond winning a championship, how we define that as a team and how we lay that out. By bringing them into that process, they're first off going to understand what the standards actually are. They're going to remember it because they were a part of that process, at least. They're going to have greater clarity on that. And there's going to be less disagreement. You know, there's going to be less argument around, well, should this be, I'm not going to say the word rule, but should this be a standard or not? Because we all kind of had this conversation. But I think it really comes back to they understand the purpose and about how these standards are going to help them to achieve the things they want to achieve as a team. They're going to help them to create the experience that they want to have as a team and also to become the players that they want to become. You know, like, I think once they see how those standards tie in with that, they're going to be way more bought into not just living by them, but helping to support their teammates in following and meeting those standards.
And I think what's so powerful about what you described there is that it isn't just getting players to understand the standards. It's getting them to understand how they benefit from living up to those standards or being challenged by those standards, and not just in terms of performance, but also the experience and how those standards are going to affect their relationships and how those standards are going to affect how they bounce back from mistakes, how they treat each other when they fall short of the standards. Like, all of those things are sort of encompassed in this approach that I think oftentimes players aren't engaged. Maybe they're in the process, but maybe not as much in the why. Why is this important? And that kind of brings me to my next question, JP, because one of the most common things that we get from coaches, so one of the most common complaints maybe that we hear in the industry is that I just don't have any good leaders on my team. My seniors don't lead, or our culture was bad last year because we just didn't have any strong leaders. And I think there are systems that are kind of scattered throughout all three phases here of establishing, supporting, and enforcing standards that create opportunities for leadership to emerge from players on the team. I don't know if you could just sort of speak to how the way these systems kind of interact with each other, how does it help leadership or leaders on a particular team to be able to grow and develop?
Well, I think to answer this, I want to just backtrack just really quickly here. So when you're talking about the standards and them being a part of establishing that process there, it really actually kind of ties in with one of the other tools that we talk about in the book, which is motivational conversations, which is really based upon the science of and research around motivational interviewing. It's getting people using questions to identify, you know, what's important to them and where they need to change to essentially, you know, realize that, you know, and get where they want to go. So when you've done something like this, the challenge is, okay, now you've given it to the players. Now where do we go with that, right? And we just hope. And here's the thing. Sometimes you do have great leaders and we celebrate that. It's great. you do this, you lay it out, they take it, they run with it. And, you know, at the end of the day, it ends up making a really, for a really great story and a great season that year. But like you said, the majority of coaches, the key influencers are not the leaders that we would desire for them to be. And I've studied so much on this as of recently around just the psychology and even just the neuroscience and of certain individuals within every culture are going to really set the tone and really have a huge impact on that environment. The way they show up, if they're high energy, everybody will be high energy. If they show up and they're grumpy, everyone feels that more so than other individuals. So there are a few individuals that are really key influencers. They're just not the leaders that we maybe desire for them to be. So we have to work with them. By implementing the leadership system, the captain's council, you know, you're essentially entering into an agreement where everyone's saying, hey, here's our influencers. And you're saying, okay, now here's our plan to work with you. You know, we're going to meet weekly. We're going to give you these opportunities to lead, you know, smaller groups. And then it's about continuously using them, working with them to actually give them real experience to follow through on like leadership type commitments, to bring issues to them, to work through those issues. Or if there is a consequence that needs to be enforced, is to have them a part of that decision-making process at different times. So really the reality is it's great to put captains in and all that stuff like that. But if you don't have, if you don't bring them into the actual leading, which so often is supporting and enforcing standards and how hard that is, if you don't bring them into that process, you're never going to allow them to grow. You're never going to be giving them opportunities to teach and work with them. And so, yes, you may have these influencers that are not great leaders, but through this experiential learning, which I point out in the book, there's a lot of research out there that would support this, that the real leadership development happens only through experiential learning. And the experiential learning comes from supporting and enforcing the standard so often.
I think JP right there, you hit the nail on the head, because so often when coaches ask me this question, it's part of me that just wants to say, your leaders are never going to develop, or your influences are never going to become the leaders that you want if you continue to hold on to everything with such a tight grip. Like, there are times where we have to be able to let go, to empower, and as you said, to let your players take some actual responsibility in the leadership of the team. And you talk about a lot of great ways to do that in the book. And I think one of the other interesting philosophy, I don't know, it's a contrast, I suppose, to what we hear a lot in the field. When we talk about supporting standards, there's a lot of times you hear teachers and coaches and even parents that are praised for having high expectations, right? The higher the expectation, the more likely you're going to get compliance or the behaviors that you want, as though that's all there is to it. And yet, I think what you kind of outline here in the supporting standards section is that there is a lot more to supporting the pursuit of those standards than just saying, here's the line, or here are the boundaries, or here are the expectations. And you create a lot of, again, great strategies to be able to do that. But why is it important? And I think this is the other key, and you mentioned this before, that supporting standards, it's not just the coach, but it's also the players that are involved, whether it's the temperature check or the standards review. Or in the one-on-ones, like the players are actively involved in helping to support and maintain the standards. What benefits have you seen from engaging the whole team in the support of the standard rather than just the leader setting the expectations?
Well, Nate, I want to come back to that word expectations first, because I really want us to move away from that word expectations, because when I have an expectation and an individual doesn't meet that expectation in my life, I have an emotional response to that. And when someone, one of my players, fails to meet my expectations or the standard, right? I don't want to be emotional about it. I want to understand that this is, I want to be, as you know, part of the process of growth. And my job is to come in there and kindly and firmly, like positive discipline talks about, and, you know, support, and then when necessary, enforce the standard, enforce consequences. So I think we need to move away from the word expectations, because I think that leads us down, you know, kind of a dangerous path. And we're trying to make a change. We're trying to be a little less emotional, a little bit more even keel as a coach. Now, why is it so important for a coach to empower the players to help support, because it's the same reason around enforcing the standard, you know, and policing the behaviors and of the team. If we're the only one do it first, that's doing it within our program, first off, we're not going to see everything, right? That's for sure, in the locker room and the group chats. So we can't be everywhere. And secondly, that's going to get exhausting for us if it's all on us, and it's going to be exhausting for them. And we're missing, and we're not leveraging the key influencers within the culture, right? Which is the peer pressure, which is just so huge for kids today. And so you can leverage positive peer pressure. And my first book, Calling Up, I talked about this idea of advocacy before accountability. And what we're trying to teach our captains, what we're trying to teach all the kids there, and is teaching them is not, you know, to police the behaviors is not about just coming there and being holding people accountable. You know, we're not expecting, you know, like we want these leaders that will call out each other out. You know, like it's not all about that. It's about people that go in there. It's a community of support. It's a community where we're all interested in what's the best interest of each individual as well as the team. And so it starts with us modeling that and then being able to teach and empower our players to do that. When you do that, when you teach them to support the standards, when you help empower them within that, while you're doing that, you're also helping them to strengthen the relationships and connections, which we talk about in that. So it's not just supporting the standards, it's supporting those relationships, those connections, because that's not a one-time process. Now, it's not a team retreat at the start of the year, and then you never sit down and make room for that throughout the year, you know? So it's kind of a joint process in that.
You mentioned the importance of that approach for enforcing standards as well. And that kind of brings me back to a phrase that we hear a lot from coaches and leaders, is that you got to fight for your culture every day. And I think inherent in that phrase, and you kind of touched on this a little bit, is the idea that it's my job to be the caretaker and the enforcer of the standards and to make sure that nobody crosses the line. And, you know, as you said, it's impossible for one person to do that. But I think the other thing that's implied in that phrase, you have to fight for your standards every day, you fight for your culture every day, is that when someone crosses the line, conflict is inevitable, that it becomes caretaker coach versus player who crossed the line, or player that didn't meet the standard, as though we're adversaries, one trying to manipulate the other. And I think what's so powerful about your approach here to enforcing standards, and again, this is one of the most common questions and challenges that coaches face, is how do we hold players accountable? And even accountability these days sort of brings us back to this idea that it's a fight. You know, it's always a tug of war, right, to get players where we want them to be. But I think your approach here in section four is completely different to that. And I wonder if you could just touch on the philosophy of, it's not really discipline, although it is. It's not exactly accountability, although it is. But it's done in a way that's, it's collaborative, it's restorative, it builds into the culture rather than taking it away. And I walk away from this section, JP, not thinking I'm in a fight. I'm thinking I'm in a relationship and we've got to get through some things, just like I do with my marriage. But I don't know if you could talk a little bit about the philosophy you're trying to lay out here to help coaches enforce their standards.
Well, it's interesting. You know, in part four, I actually share the story of this community court up in New York that started to take a totally drastically different approach towards policing, I guess, behaviors within the community, right? So they made changes in every aspect of justice, right? So it all became around, they got rid of the old courtroom. They made it an actual pleasant experience based upon just changing colors and pictures. And, you know, the judge wasn't high up, you know, on this, you know, this chair. He was actually sitting at level, you know, at eye level with, you know, whoever was being, you know, brought in there for, you know, some, you know, crime that they had been pulled up on. You know, it's just a drastically different experience in the sense that they were actually encouraging cheering, you know, and clapping and laughing within the courtroom. And it always, when I read about that story years ago, it always, you know, really resonated with me, is why does discipline, why does accountability have to feel so negative? Why does it always have to be conflict? It doesn't, you know, and this story of this community court, you know, in one of the worst areas in the US, you know, it drastically changed the crime. It was a drastic drop in crime level within that community. And it's a powerful story, and it's a great reminder to us of, if we can just change the experience of discipline to something less of like, here, I'm the accountability police, and more so of like, I'm your accountability partner. You know, like we always talk about like, hey, how helpful it can be to have an accountability partner when you make a commitment or you say, I have a goal, I'm going to lose some weight. Well, what can I do? I can go, oh, I can have a buddy that, you know, we're going to support each other in this. You know, we're going to remind each other. We're going to hold each other accountable. We're going to celebrate when we're on path, and we're going to, you know, that's the relationship that we're trying to enter in within as the team, is that, listen, we're going to fail here. We're going to not always meet the standard. We get that. We're not expecting anybody to be perfect here, but we've agreed, as we in the establishing part, we've agreed to these consequences to help keep us on track, because permissiveness isn't going to take us where we want to go. So we have to have consequences. Everybody agrees that this is the consequences and the approach that we're going to take. We've all agreed to it. So that way, not only is the standard clear on the team, and people aren't confused on that, but when they don't meet the standard, they know what they've chosen, and they know, okay, well, here's the consequence, and we agree to that. You know, and it's all of a sudden it takes a lot of the conflict out of accountability. It's not perfect. Doesn't mean there's not ever issues or players don't appreciate the discipline in that moment. But in our experience, you know, 95%+ of the time, the player, even in those emotional moments, will come around to remember, oh, this is what I agreed to, you know, and appreciate the coach actually enforcing some standards.
It reminds me, JP, of a show that you and I have both plowed through, Ozark. And there's a line in there when Marty, the dad, is talking to Wendy, the mom, and one of the kids just got in trouble for starting their own money laundering business or something like that. And Marty says to his wife, Wendy, do you think grounding really works? And when I heard him say that, like implied in that, and I think coaches would say the same thing, like, is it just punishment? Does punishment really work when it comes to trying to get lasting change in our players? I think most of us would agree that it doesn't. But I also think most coaches are left in a place where we don't know what alternatives there are. And of all the things that are, you know, unique and valuable in this book, I think coaches are going to be drawn to the idea that here's the guidebook. Here are some tools for conversations, for creative discipline, for establishing some consequences that affirm relationships rather than rupture them. And you just don't find, you know, those tools in very many places, because I think we can all agree grounding doesn't work very well.
Yeah. And this is why I'm so excited to kind of get the book out when I am, because I really think it's important that not only is the head coach of every team in line with some of those enforcement of consequences, but all the staff are part of that, because I think it helps to have consistency across the board that's necessary for it to be effective. And it doesn't work for the head coach to maybe, you know, take a little bit more of a transformational type of approach to enforcing the standards, but then the assistant coach is over there going crazy and he's putting guys online and running them and all this, you know, grounding, like you said, you know, it just really can kind of just work against, you know, what the head coach is trying to do. And so, yes, I think there is real value and maybe this alternative type approach that we've been using, but I'd also just remind coaches that it's not all negative. You know, we start with how do we reinforce, you know, these standards by celebrating the good things that are happening when people, you know, make the mark as well too. So it's a very, very different approach for sure.
All right. I got two more questions for you here, JP, and then we'll get you out of here. I want to ask a specific question about the last chapter. Chapter number 20 is called You Can't Be for Everyone, Removing Culture Killers. And you make an argument, we've talked about this on the podcast before, that there comes a time where it's necessary to part ways with those that essentially are not going to get on board with the standards, with the culture, with the direction, and that's better for everybody. I think so often coaches, for lack of a better word, and I would include myself in this group, lack the courage to be able to make those difficult decisions. But oftentimes, the fate of the culture rests on our ability to be able to let a culture killer go. For those of us that might be conflict avoiders and don't want to go through that process, Make an argument for me, JP. Why is that so important?
Well, there's just so many, well, Nate, there's just so much evidence and examples that I could share with you where removing a player from the team has not only benefited the team, but it's actually benefited the individual that was removed. And I tell an amazing story, and I don't want to ruin it, at the end of there, of our friend Boomer Roberts and his story, that when I called up Boomer to kind of re-interview, I know he had told us the story before, it actually brought me to tears. And, you know, it's just because it's so powerful, it's so moving. But there's other stories like Boomer's where when we remove that player and we do it in a way that's respectful of their person and their dignity, that's a really culture-defining moment. It's a huge, huge culture-defining moment is when people leave our team, especially if we've been the person to let them go. The tricky part about this, though, is everyone's context is different. You know, what becomes too far? And what I'll say is I try to give coaches a lot of different guiding principles to help them to make the right decision. And to make when they make that decision, to do it in a way, like I said, that is respectful of the individual. And I think at the end of the day, Nate, like in the example with Boomer, Boomer has a mission as a coach. He has a purpose, and that's to impact the lives of his players, to help them to become better men. I believe his mission statement is something around raising, you know, them to be, you know, great husbands and fathers. And he can't stay true to that if he loses his culture. And that player on that team forced him into a decision because he was failing to buy into the culture and it was killing the culture. And so now Boomer can't live out his mission. And so he makes that decision. He enforces it in a way that's respectful and kind. And, you know, at the end of the day, that guy still loves him as a coach, you know, and he comes back to it. And there's this great, great story at the end of just of the story of reconnection, but also that player learning from that experience. And when we do it in a way that's respectful of the person, we just like all of this enforcing standards I talk about, we're constantly reinforcing choice. You had a choice. You chose to do this. You chose to act this way. Now there's a consequence. You knew what the consequence would be. And when we reinforce that choice, we're kind of forcing someone into this situation where we're really encouraging them and empowering them to take responsibility for their decisions in life. But if we continue to allow our players to act in a certain way and let them off the hook, we're not forcing them to take responsibility for their decisions, their actions, their choices. And it absolutely sucks when a coach gets to that point where they have to let someone go. But like I said, it could be the biggest learning experience in their life when you make that hard choice.
Well, I love that story from our friend Boomer, and you can listen to it on the podcast. Obviously, it's in the book. I want to get you out of here on this, JP. We asked this question of Daniel Coyle when we had him on a couple of weeks ago about his book, the Culture Playbook. When you look back at this, and as you mentioned, it's kind of been a four-year process of putting this together and doing the research and experimenting with coaches. What are you most proud of when it comes to this second book?
Without a doubt for me, I'm most proud of the fact that I took the time to really work and collaborate over these last few years and even in the last year in the writing process with the coaches that are actually in the fight. You know, we got a great editor, we got great people, we got great graphics, it's got a great layout. All those things I think are really high level in the book. But I really worked hard to make sure that this is meeting a need for coaches out there today. And so I constantly was opening myself up to feedback throughout this writing process. And at one stage in last fall, I asked many of the coaches in the TOC community, and we had about 12 that went through the entire process with me, and some kind of jumped in and out. But I'd send everybody a chapter. And I'd say, what'd you like? What didn't you like? What's missing? What needs to be cut? And they just let me have it. You know, a lot of it was great affirmation, but was, you know, which was needed. But there's also some really good feedback of, you know, this isn't working here or there as far as just application, you know, and clarity. So by working with all these coaches, I think I was able to put together a book here that is going to help a lot of other coaches in the way that me and you have helped people these last few years, you know, with some of these things that they're doing to grow their culture and grow as a leader. And I think that's what I'm most proud of is just, I know this is going to impact a lot of coaches' lives now because of not just me, but because of all these amazing other coaches that worked with me on it.
Well, JP, I want to wrap up with one more quote that I heard Cody Royal share on that recent interview. And he was talking about why organizations fail. And he was referring to a Bill Walsh quote, and I'm going to butcher the quote, so I apologize. This isn't word for word, but essentially Walsh said, the biggest problem with organizations is their organization. And when I think about what is the biggest need of coaches that have good intentions, but good intentions are not enough. It's the need for systems, as you've laid out in the book. It's the need for practical tools that have been tested in the field that can be manipulated to fit your context and your leaders and your level and your sport. And I think that that's what this book can do for coaches. It's a way for us to refine our organization so that the organization doesn't become the obstacle to our team's success.
All right, that's it for my conversation with Nate. Kind of want to share a few thoughts here post discussion there, just kind of after the edits. In 2017, my family moved from Tennessee, where I coached high school basketball, to Pennsylvania, and I decided to not jump right back into head coaching, which I've been doing for over a decade, both in Tennessee and internationally in Ireland and Lithuania. Instead, I kind of set out on this journey to better understand team culture, how to build it, and to work to try to share my learnings with others. In September of 2017, this podcast was started. In January of 2018, I started writing my first book, Calling Up, and it was published in September of 2018. Calling Up was the principles and strategies that I knew up to that point from my own experience and study. Also in January of 2018, I started supporting a handful of coaches who were eager to implement some of the ideas that I was writing about and sharing on the podcast, and also to utilize me as a sounding board throughout their seasons. Over the next 5 years, I'd go on to work with over 75 leaders all throughout the world. However, back in March of 2018, I actually started the first outline for the culture system. It was really right after I had finished writing the initial manuscript for Calling Up. And then over the next 5 years, that outline would have piles of notes, stories, and ideas added to it, subtracted from it, and changed. And in 2021, I really started to dig in on the writing. But even as the writing was going on, we were learning, me and all the coaches and leaders I was working with. And just this last week, June of 2022, the culture system was finally published. Now, I had a coach who I've supported for the last 4 years ask me just this week, when I look back on it all, how do I feel? Now, the truth is, when I look back on the journey, I don't feel this huge sense of pride. In this interview, you just heard Nate actually ask me what I'm most proud of. And in the moment, it stumped me. I really struggled to answer because genuinely, the overwhelming emotion last night as I hit publish, and then when I woke up this morning, was gratitude, not pride. In my journal this morning, I wrote, it's not a deep sense of pride, but it's a deep sense of gratitude. I've been fortunate, lucky, and blessed to have the support of some amazing people. The support of my wife, Melissa, my deepest friend, John Wilson, who, you know, over 20 years ago, we spent our summer days sweating in a gym together, training in basketball. And now we support each other all these years later, talking weekly about personal growth, leadership, family, all the important things in life. I've had people like Justin Simpkins, the owner of Prairie Hockey Academy, who I met over 7 years ago in the mentorship program with Jamie Gilbert. You know, we've both set out on similar journeys to change sports for the better. I've been blessed to know and support so many amazing coaches, and they've supported me in return. 10 of them need special acknowledgement because last September, 10 of them read each chapter of one of the earliest versions of my book, The Culture System. Sean Keating at St. Peter's High School, Minnesota. Troy Weedman, the director at Reaching Higher, Angel Elderkin, the head women's basketball coach at Appalachian State, Mark Cassio, the assistant at Appalachian State and the owner of Courtside Consulting, Jack Fleming, the assistant at the Tasmanian Jack Jumpers, a professional NBL team in Australia, Darren Douglas, Grovetown High School in Georgia, Andy Cerrone at Sussex Hamilton in Wisconsin, Al Baker, the athletic director at Woodstock High School in Illinois, and Jonathan Dzinski at Woodbridge High School in Jersey, and David Givens, formerly at Rockville High School in Tennessee. These 10 people, in one of the busiest times of their year, which is, you know, early in their season, they slogged through over 100,000 words. Now it's only 65,000, just for reference. But they had to read it on Google Docs. They had to endure the horrible writing, the poor structure, and all that. Trust me, it was not pretty. I tell Nate Sanderson all the time that he's the writer in our family. Now, when you read this book, I really believe each of you are going to love it. And it's going to help you. It's going to help you grow as a leader and to build your team's culture. And I'm sharing this because that impact is not down to my genius on any part. It's due to the opportunities and support others have given me along the journey. So thank you. Thank you to everyone that has allowed me to support them, or even just you as a listener that, you know, tune in each week, listen to these episodes. Without you, this would never have happened. This would never have come together. So please be sure to go out and buy a copy of the book for you and your staff today. And tune in next week. We've got some great episodes around mental health as we talk with the CEO of Hone Athletics.